Friends, today we are looking at the psalm, which is commonly referred to as a song of ascent. These are songs of ascent or psalms of ascent or a collection of kind of pilgrimage songs that the people of Israel would sing on their way to the temple, on their way to Jerusalem to worship. Keep in mind that the Psalms, many of them are just recorded prayers of God's people. As we read them, it's as if we're kind of looking over the shoulders of the writer of the psalm and kind of listening in on their conversations. The devout Israelite people, they knew Jerusalem was their place to worship. That was the place to go to meet with God. And they would try to find a way to get to Jerusalem at least three times a year if they could. And depending on how far away they lived, of course, it could take anywhere from hours to weeks to make that journey in Israel. And it was a big deal. Think of how much planning and merchandising and hype goes into, say, the Super Bowl. Long before the Super Bowl actually happens. Unless you're a Detroit fan, then it's like, what Super Bowl? Yeah, I read about that somewhere. But I mean, we know what it is, that excitement is already, that anticipation is already happening here as we think of the possibility or the Olympics coming up very soon. And already the merchandising is starting and the advertising. And before the games begin, there's already a sense of celebration that's going on. And that's what's happening in these Psalms of Ascent. That's what's happening in Psalm 122. The people of God, they're beginning to worship even before they get to the temple. They're beginning to celebrate even before they get to Jerusalem. Jerusalem was located on the top of a mountain, on the top of a tall hill, and the temple was the tallest spot in the city of Jerusalem. So it's why it's called a song of ascent. You sing this as you're ascending Mount Zion, as you're going up to Jerusalem, going up to the temple. So we're overhearing this conversation this morning. We're listening in on what's going on as God's people are preparing for worship. And just incidentally, step back and wonder, what would people hear if they listened in on our conversations as we were getting ready for worship, and maybe at home as we were getting ready, or maybe in the drive into church? What kinds of things would people overhear in our conversation? Worth pondering. It's worth thinking about. But let's listen. Let's listen to the psalmist and see what he's talking about and as they are making their way up the mountain to worship in Jerusalem. The psalm can pretty easily be divided into three segments. In fact, the NIV authors, if you look carefully, if you have a Bible, you'll see the divisions that were read this morning are actually divisions in the text. The first two verses kind of form the first stanza. And this first stanza that describes the departure and the arrival of the worshipers at the city of Jerusalem at the gate, and they've made it to their destination, and now it's as if they're kind of reflecting back on that moment when they set out for the trip. It's as if in verse 1, the dad yells, "All right, let's get in the minivan, we're headed to church." Or, "Let's pack the camel," as the case may be. We're going up to Jerusalem. And that's that first stanza, reflecting on that leaving to go to Jerusalem. The second stanza is verses 3 to 5, and there depicts the travelers standing at the entrance to the city, and they're describing what they see, and they're describing what it means to them as they look into the city of Jerusalem, as they gaze at the temple and what they see before him. This section describes, first of all, simply just admiration for the city, how it's laid out, how beautiful it is. And then verse 4, they think about all the people that they're going to meet in the city. And they've come from far and near and all over the country. But there's this deep unity that, in spite of the fact that there are different people coming from different places, there are a multitude coming with the same purpose, to praise God, to praise the name of the Lord, to worship God. And then verse 5 also mentions the throne of David and his royal successors. Kind of a recognition that they're seeing kind of the center of justice for the land of Israel as they look into the city of Jerusalem. Some of you know what that's like if you've ever visited Washington, D.C. Just walking around, you see the Capitol building or you see the Supreme Court building or some of those magnificent buildings. It just stirs something deep within you that this is where it happens in terms of justice and the law and our governance. And that's kind of what's happening. You get that sense of awe and respect for the institutions of justice and government as you look at these buildings. And that's kind of the thing that's happening as these worshipers are gazing upon the city of Jerusalem. They see those centers of justice and law and governance. Finally, in verses 6 to 8, it's the last stanza where the psalmist kind of in a way greets and salutes the city. And we might look at those verses and think a little bit strange that the psalmist would talk about the city in those kinds of terms. It almost seems like the psalmist is talking to the city itself. Seems a little bizarre, but you have to remember, for the people of Israel, the temple and Jerusalem, in which the temple resided, it wasn't just the center of faith for the people of Israel. This was the center of political life. This was the center of military and legal and justice life. This was the center of life for the people of Israel. It was their city, and so it wasn't really strange to wish peace upon their city, to wish blessing upon it. It's almost kind of a patriotic stanza. If you think of yourself as an Israelite, these are the kinds of words that you would say on, or that you would sing about on the 4th of July, for instance, or some other patriotic kind of holiday. And we know what this is sort of like. There's that old hymn, My Country, 'Tis of Thee. One of the stanzas says, my native country, thee, land of the noble free, thy name I love. I love thy rocks and thy rills, thy wood and templed hills. My heart with rapture thrills like that above. So it's in that kind of patriotic vein that the psalmist is writing here in this last stanza. So what does this teach us? Because it's not easy. And again, to handle this psalm appropriately and carefully, we have to remember it was not written to instruct us. That's not why the psalm writer wrote it down, thinking, I have to share with those folks in Kennewick how to get ready for worship. It wasn't that way. It was written as people are on their way to worship. They're just recording the kinds of praise that are coming out of the mouths of God's people as they're worshiping and as they're preparing to ascend to Jerusalem. They were on their way. They're excited. The anticipation is growing. And this is the stuff that came out. And so there are differences. As we think of our experiences, we think of the experience of the psalmist, there are differences, right? We don't make significant large pilgrimages to a holy place two or three times a year in order to worship God at great expense and with great investment. We don't do that. And most of us, maybe it's a 20-minute trip across town to get to church, and we do so much more regularly. And it doesn't cost us near as much as it cost the Israelites to make that journey. And so there's a little difference there. And understand, too, that the experience of worship at the temple was quite different than our experience of worship. The prayers, the singing, the instruction, the reading from God's Word, all of those things that we are used to in worship, some of it was there, but the heart of temple worship was the sacrifice, the sacrifices. There was some of that other stuff, but the sacrificial ceremonies were the heart of temple worship. And so corporate prayer and the scripture reading and the instruction and the singing, those kinds of things, those things took place in the local synagogues, not in the temple. And of course, another major difference is that the heart of religious worship in the temple was tied very much to the heart of political and social and justice life in Israel. It was tied to Jerusalem as the political center of the nation. We have a hard time relating to that. We don't normally think of Washington, D.C. as the heart, the core of our faith. Right? I mean, sometimes we think our faith in Washington, D.C. seems world apart in some ways. And so there's a number of significant differences, some cultural gaps, as it were, that we need to be able to step over in order to let this psalm instruct us. And not just this psalm, but the other psalms of ascent as well. But there is much we can learn. First thing we learn, they started singing long before worship, actual, like formal worship began. There was joyful preparation. This journey was important. And in fact, it was so important that there are 15 psalms of ascent that are collected in the Psalms. I mean, just that alone tells us something about the significance of getting ready for worship, of preparing for worship, that 15 of the psalms that we have in our collection in the Bible are psalms of ascent. They were significant in the religious life of the people of Israel. And that alone is instructive. They were prepared for worship. The worship event shaped their lives not just during those moments they were actually in the temple, but it shaped their lives in those moments surrounding the time when they were actually in the temple. And that's something we should learn from and can learn from. Because let's admit it, worship is a rather challenging activity, right? Get to the heart of it, we're trying to engage in a dialogue with a divine, invisible being. It's rather difficult. We aim to meet someone that we're not able to see. And when the Israelites ascended Mount Zion on their way to worship, they didn't go lightly. They knew they were on their way to a royal gathering, a royal meeting, and they gave this event great care and great thought. In the same way, church just can't be just about the hour, hour and a half or so that we just spend here. But in learning from the Israelites in this psalm, let this event of worship shape your hours actually before you come to church. Break yourself of the habit of seeing Sunday as the day to sleep in as long as you can and still make it to church on time, or at least not be too late, right? Wake up early enough to prepare, to think about what it is you're doing, to pray about it, to get excited about it. Maybe read the passage ahead of time. Think about, I'm meeting God in another hour, hour and a half. This isn't something I want to take lightly and just fall into. It's not something I want to be rushed and panicked about. But I want to be able to be like the Israelites, preparing my hearts and worshiping already before we even come into the sanctuary. Notice also there's kind of a positive vibe going on. There's there's an excitement, right? In the very first verses, I rejoiced with those who said to me. There's this excitement. The psalmist rejoices to go to worship. One author, Dorothy Bass, she writes about this family, or her family, who found a very novel way to make Sunday special. Her family decided Sunday is a no criticism day. Absolutely no criticism is allowed in the house all day on Sunday. Doesn't matter what the kids do or don't do. Doesn't matter what mom or dad do or don't do. No criticism is allowed. And she said one of the interesting kind of effects of that decision and that agreement with the family is that her kids' friends ended up spending a lot of Sundays in her home. Wouldn't that be a great agreement to have around here? Just Sunday. No criticism allowed. Because if worship is about meeting God, then to stand back and say, well, that song wasn't done right, or the cookies weren't to my liking, or whatever. I mean, that really doesn't have a place. If worship is a time and a place to meet God, then I don't think this should have been done this way. This isn't the time or the place for it. This is a place to meet God. Criticism just doesn't fit that context. Remember how worship at this time in history in the Psalms, it centered mainly on sacrifices, broken people, sinful people, finding cleansing and redemption to stand before a holy and a righteous God through the shed blood of the Old Testament sacrificial system. Now draw a line from that to today. How has that changed? How is it the same? Well, let me read you a little passage from Hebrews chapter 12. It talks about how Jesus has established a new spiritual temple by the sacrifice of himself on the cross. And so he brings us into a new Zion, a new Jerusalem through his sacrifice. Listen to Hebrews 12. But you have come to Mount Zion. You have come to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to the mediator of a new covenant, to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. See what the writer of the Hebrews is saying? Worship isn't primarily about what we do. Worship is about coming into the presence of a God who does for us, who cleanses us, who brings redemption for us and freedom for us so we can stand before that holy God. That's the heart of worship, is what God has done for us, what Jesus Christ has done for us on the cross. Jesus Christ is the main participant in worship. And so the psalm calls us to prepare to meet with Christ, to be renewed by the gospel of grace, to hear again the gospel's claim on every area of our life. Now, obviously, we don't cover every area of our life on every worship time, but that's what it's about, of meeting Jesus who's given himself for us. And what does that mean then for my marriage? What does that mean then for my honesty? What does that mean then for my sex life? What does this mean then for how I handle money or how I handle power? But it begins with what Christ has done for us, his sprinkling shed blood to bring us to God. That's why we can hold off on criticism, right? On Sunday, because it's not ultimately about us. Ultimately, it's about what Jesus has done on our behalf. Part of the excitement also in this psalm, if you notice, is that the worshipers are going to worship God in community. We see this especially in verse 4. They're excited to rub shoulders with other people, with other worshipers, people from all over the place. There's this old story that's told, I don't know if it's true or not, but it makes a good point. This poor traveler who is just amazed by the welcome he receives at this monastery. He served a lavish meal. He was just traveling through and just was looking for a place to lay his head for the night. But they take him in. They serve him a lavish meal. They give him the best room in the place. He's given new clothes to replace the rags that he arrives in. And before leaving the next morning, this traveler says to the abbot, he just comments on how well he's been treated while he's been at the monastery. Yes, the abbot said, we treat all our guests as if they're angels, just to be on the safe side, because someday they might be. There's a great privilege to worshiping God in community. Now, none of us are going to become angels. I mean, it doesn't work that way, but C.S. Lewis says, take a look around you when you worship, and you are looking at people who, in eternity, are going to be so beautiful and so glorious that if you were to see these people now, you'd be tempted to fall on your knees and worship them. That's the future that we have. That's the future of every follower of Jesus Christ. And we get the privilege of worshiping with each other, of standing shoulder to shoulder. It's a privilege. So it's a good idea to maybe come to church a little early. Look over the prayer request. Look over the bulletin. See who's involved in different ministries. And just remember the privilege of getting to worship with these people. And pray for them. Spend some time thinking about this preparation to worship with these people. This is where we're coming to meet God through the atoning work of Jesus Christ on our behalf. And then we joyfully respond with vows and with commitments. And the psalmist is just kind of makes a kind of veiled reference to, you know, his vows and commitments. Talks in that last verse about seeking the prosperity of the house of the Lord. Keep in mind, this is a psalm of ascent. This is still in preparation, but it's a veiled reference to the kinds of commitments that the psalmist would make. And we find that later on in the acts of worship. But that's what we do. Let's not enter into this event lightly. Let's not enter into it hurriedly, without preparation. We're here to meet God. Let's get ready for that.